This interview was produced for Red Eye, a 3-hour current affairs program on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 102.7 FM.
There are tens of millions of people who, at great sacrifice and often enormous risk, are trying to reach a country where they can find work. And with the little money they earn, they try to send back some to their families in the homelands they have left. To discuss these remittance payments, as they are called, we've reached David Bacon in San Francisco. David has been a labor organizer and now works as a labor journalist and photographer. He was one of the organizers of U.S. Labor Against the War and is the author of the recently published book, Children of NAFTA. Good morning, David.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be with you and your listeners.
What are the main countries that workers abroad send remittances home to?
Oh, there's a long, long list. And we're speaking here of the U.S. Canada, I can make some guesses, but I'm not as knowledgeable about immigration into Canada. For the U.S., the number one country is Mexico. Probably the second country after that is China. And then from there, I think we're talking about countries in Central America like El Salvador, Guatemala, the Philippines, of course, Southeast Asia. But increasingly, migrants are coming to the U.S. from countries like Ecuador, for instance, in South America itself. Or there's now a growth in African migration, especially to the U.S. East Coast and to the South. So these are countries where the amount of migration to the U.S. before was relatively small, and it's rising. In Canada, to my knowledge, the principal countries, or some of the principal countries, are, first of all, the countries of the Asian Pacific Rim, including China, the Philippines, and then also there's a very significant amount of migration to Canada from Mexico, of course, and also from countries of the Caribbean, especially because of Canada's guest worker program, which primarily brings people from the Caribbean to farms in the eastern part of Canada.
In total, how large are these remittances?
Well, just to give you an idea, the Mexican government estimates that last year the total quantity of remittances from the from people working in the U.S. to their families at home in Mexico totaled more than $17 billion. That is more than any other single source of national income in Mexico except for the oil industry. In other words, there are more dollars coming into Mexico from remittances than there are, for instance, from tourism. And tourism in Mexico is a huge business. It's more than the maquiladoras on the border. It's really an enormous quantity of money. And while, the amount of remittances to other countries is somewhat smaller, it's still very, very significant. Even during the U.S. war in Central America, the amount of remittances going to El Salvador from Salvadorans who had come to the U.S. as refugees was the biggest single source of national income in El Salvador.
On an individual basis, how much do individual workers remit?
Well, that's a wildly varying amount of money. But the one way to look at it is to remember that the people who are coming to the U.S. and Canada to work are generally working at very, very close to minimum wage. So in the U.S., that would be $6.75 an hour, which is approximately just short of $300 a week. Now, I recently did some reporting on a community of workers from southern Mexico, from the state of Oaxaca, who were living under the trees, out in the open, in the wine country in the Napa and Sonoma counties, where the premium wine in California is made. This group of workers was living outside in part because their wages were so low, but also because they wanted to be able to send as much money home to their families as possible. And rents being as high as they are in the wine country, they felt that it was in some ways cheaper for them to live out in the open than it was to rent an apartment in town. The living conditions for migrant Mexican workers in agricultural areas of both the U.S. and Canada are very poor, so that, for instance, it's not uncommon to find a group of 10 or 12 people sharing a one-bedroom apartment and even sleeping in shifts, depending on the kind of work that people are doing. So this way people are able to save money and send it home to their families. Exactly how much of that, say, $250 a week people are able to send home, I would say half of it. You know, half of it might be a good guess. But obviously it really depends a great deal on the individual situation of the people involved.
So what does this flow of money and people, this pattern, tell us about global inequities in wealth?
Oh, it tells us a great deal. First of all, just the size of it should tell us something. You know, this is really migration on a really enormous scale. Obviously, one thing it means is that the economies of countries like Canada, the U.S., Great Britain, many countries in Western Europe has become very dependent on the labor of migrants in order to function. So if we took this migrant labor out of the picture, as some of the nativist restrictionists would have us do, our economies would collapse, basically. You remember there was just a movie that was made called A Day Without Mexicans to sort of dramatize this idea of what that would mean. But the problem is that this migration is happening because of the enormous difference in the standards of living of countries like Mexico and Central America and countries like the U.S. and Canada. That's what's propelling it. People are coming here in search of jobs and economic opportunity, and also leaving countries where it's becoming more and more difficult to survive. One of the reasons why it's becoming difficult to survive is because of the economic and trade policies that are being imposed by wealthy countries. Let's talk about NAFTA here for a second. In the years that NAFTA has been in effect, since 1994, the amount of corn exported from the U.S., from huge agricultural farms in California and Iowa, say, to Mexico, has gone up by 15 times. What that means is that Mexico, which is a corn-producing country, for small farmers, you know, out in the rural areas of Mexico, it's become almost impossible for people to grow corn and sell it, which means that people can't make a living on the land, migrate to the cities, and migrate to the north. So this was a good, NAFTA was a pretty good deal for companies like ConAgra or Cargill or Continental Grain Company that export the corn, but it had a huge price in terms of human suffering and also the kind of migration that it helped to produce. So that's what's producing this wave of migration. And then what happens is people, of course, arrive in Canada and the U.S. They go to work for large corporations, which take advantage of the low wages that they're able to impose on these migrant workers. And then those migrant workers have to support their communities back at home, their families, with the remittances that they send back. So that the cost of schools, for instance, or of public works projects, or really all of the costs that it takes to maintain a community in Oaxaca, in southern Mexico, is paid not by the companies that export the corn, and it's not paid by the companies that employ the migrant workers in the U.S. and Canada. It's paid by people themselves. So these remittances, essentially, are the payments that allow the home communities of migrants to survive. So this is a very unjust system, because those people who reap the most benefit from it are not paying the costs that it takes to produce this kind of workforce that they in turn are taking advantage of.
So what's the effect in the towns and the villages that actually are on the receiving end of these payments, remittance payments?
Well, it's very complicated. First of all, one of the effects is that these are towns where people of working age, between the ages of, say, you know, 20 and 40, there's very few of those folks that live in these towns during most parts of the year, because people are off working in the United States. It used to be that this was especially men, but in recent years the migration of women has become much greater than it was beforehand. So in some ways, what you see when you go to a small town in Oaxaca is you see a lot of old folks and a lot of children, but you don't see a lot of people in between, other than in the holidays when sometimes people are able to come back and visit their families. Another thing that you see is an increasing difference in the standard of living between those families that have relatives who are working in the U.S. and Canada and those families who don't, because the access to these remittances does in fact produce a certain rise in the standard of living for those families. They can afford to, you know, repair their houses, buy land. Those families that don't have relatives who are migrants are often become workers for the families that do. So we're seeing a sort of an increasing class differentiation in those towns. And the final thing that you see, which is really one of the, I think, most problematic results of migration, is the impact on young people and on youth. Because a young person in a junior high school class in a small town in Mexico looks at his teacher or her teacher and asks himself or herself, why should I study hard, try to go to college, when the teacher who's standing in front of me is making less money than my own relative who's working at minimum wage in the fields in California? So what the impact that this has on education, on culture, on the fabric of life in these communities is very, very serious.
So how do the governments in the South look at this pattern of migration remittance payments?
Well, I think it depends on who those governments are. Right now, the Mexican government is a very conservative government, and it's sort of bought into this whole neoliberal model, and it, in a way, is proud of it. It brags about, you know, the amount of money sent by those hard-working Mexicans at home, but doesn't say really very much about the course of economic development that Mexico is pursuing as a country, and the fact that the Mexican government right now is unable to produce enough jobs for its own population or enough income in rural areas. In fact, it's, you know, rural income is declining. The Mexican government does admit, for instance, that 40% of Mexicans live in poverty, as the Mexican government defines it, and 20% live in what it says is extreme poverty, and almost all of those people live in rural areas. But there's not an economic development program in Mexico that would allow people to remain, you know, on the farms in small towns and survive. Instead, you know, Mexico and countries like Mexico have bought into the idea that by maintaining a low standard of living, they are going to be able to attract the investment of companies which locate factories like maquiladoras in order to take advantage of low wages, essentially. So really, the economic policies that it's following are producing more migrants and therefore more remittances. And so while the Mexican government is pretty happy to talk about the quantity of the remittances and the moral responsibility that they represent in terms of people's willingness to help their families and their home communities, it's pretty quiet about the responsibility of the government itself to produce a higher standard of living.
Thanks very much, David, for taking the time to talk to us this morning about this really important issue.
My pleasure being with you.
I've been speaking with David Bacon. He's a Labour journalist and photographer. And to read his articles and see his photographs, you can go to his website, and that's dbacon, D-B-A-C-O-N, .igc.org.
Red Eye is produced by an independent media collective and airs on Vancouver Cooperative Radio. You can hear the program from 9 until noon Pacific Time, streaming live at cooperadio.org.